This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Dig for victory.
If you eat food, maybe you've noticed groceries cost more and more. Well, stock up now. Food inflation is just ramping up. It's not just the extra 200 million mouths to feed on the planet next year. Climate change is already rearranging your food bill. In North America and around the world, one big driver is the record drought in the prime crop production areas of the United States this year. Many meat producers gave up selling off their herds. That temporarily kept meat prices lower. The current cattle herd is the smallest since 1973. Once that sell-off goes through the supply chain, the high cost of corn and other grains will accelerate meat prices from 5 to 10% higher, according to one Canadian report. Here is Peter Mansbridge, the host of The National on the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, on December 6, 2012.
If you are buying extra groceries for the holidays, some experts suggest you also might think about stocking up for the coming year. The price of food, especially meat, is expected to jump soon.
Next comes CBC Consumer Affairs reporter Aaron Saltzman with a report from Canada's premier agricultural university in Guelph, Ontario.
They'll soon learn it's about to get even more expensive, no matter where they shop. According to the University of Guelph's annual food forecast, just about every basic staple will cost more next year. Dairy up as much as 3%. Breads up as much as 4%. Eggs up as much as 5%, but likely the biggest hike...
We would expect meats, particularly beef and pork, to go up more significantly. We're saying probably as much as 4.5 to 6%.
The price of pork, in particular, expected to jump by as much as 10%. According to the report, the main driver behind most of these price increases is climate. The drought across parts of North America this past year was one of the worst in recorded history. Among the hardest hit areas, the Great Plains states in the U.S., America's breadbasket. That drove up grain prices and, in turn, the cost of feed and livestock.
So some predictions there about food prices in the future. What about the changes we've already seen? Here are some numbers to consider. According to Statistics Canada, the cost of meat has risen more than 30% in the past decade. Egg prices have risen by 50%. Bakery products are up by nearly 60%. By comparison, fresh vegetables cost about 1% less than 10 years ago.
That was CBC News. Don't be thrown off by comforting reports from the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization. Their early December report says basic food prices fell by 1.5% in November. That was partially caused by a massive drop in the price of sugar. But as the World Bank reports, food prices are currently stable, but still very high. In fact, expensive food hovering near the record 2008 levels is the new normal. Unlike the UN, the World Food Bank Price Index finds food prices are 7% higher than in 2011. Grains are 12% higher already from the previous year. In the United Kingdom, the November Shop Price Index shows food prices up 4.6% from a year ago. Fresh fruits and vegetables are particularly high there, causing what the Guardian newspaper calls a nutrition recession in Britain. A series of reports in the Australian press says food prices there will hit a new record high in 2013. The cost of rice, wheat, pulses, edible oil, sugar, and vegetables are all rising in India. Bloomberg Business finds American meat prices are set to go much higher. Quote from Bloomberg, "The drought in the Midwest and Great Plains drove corn yields to a 17-year low and may last at least through February. U.S. consumers will pay 3% to 4% more for food next year, a half percentage point above this year's expected increase, according to the USDA." End quote from Bloomberg. It's not just the drought. A weird bout of summer-like weather in March 2012 caused many fruit trees to bloom early. The return of cold weather killed off the flowers, leading to a drop of the apple crop by as much as 80% in some regions. The world charity Oxfam has a special report on the impact of extreme weather events on the world food supply. And don't forget those great storms.
Do you like standing in a queue for your vegetables? Or do you think it's tiring and a waste of valuable time? Do you ever find your long wait has been useless, that supplies of what you want have run out before your turn comes? It's not the greengrocer's fault. It's up to you. Dig for victory. Thousands of people have discovered that a 10-rod plot will keep a family of five in vegetables 8 months of the year. Young men are doing it, and young women. These girls are using part of their lunch hour to work on plots in their own factory grounds. Old men, even at 83. And children, growing food is part of their school routine nowadays. For they know that food is just as important a weapon of war as guns.
Wait a minute. Didn't I promise you some good news this week? Sure, if more people can't afford red meat, their health will improve dramatically. Healthy vegetables are still the most affordable option in most places, but it gets much better than that. We can quickly and cheaply convert most of our cities into major food production centers. In this program, you will hear how it happened before and how local urban food production is making a rapid comeback. The kicker is, lots of folks are going for more than just the joy of healthy, self-grown food. They come for the new sense of community as well. Most of us can't afford to just kick off and head to the country. We need some income, at least to make the transition. So like Havana, Cuba, after the Soviet Empire died and stopped sending oil, we'll have to feed ourselves where we are. We are going to the city of Chicago, where the American Victory Garden movement was launched during World War II, and where it is coming back strong now. From the Great Lakes Bioneers Conference, we have an excellent recording of Lamanda Joy, founder of the Peterson Garden Project. She tells us about the Victory Garden movement, where hundreds of thousands of novice growers produced mountains of food for the war effort, how a whole nation can transform into local food production in just 1 year. That's not just something that happened in the past. Lamanda will tell us how Chicago is organizing once again to bring back urban food production. Whether you are concerned about economic collapse, climate change, peak oil, or just healthy food with no GMOs in it, this speech is a message of hope for all of us. This recording was made by Kelly Pierce of the Chicago Independent Media Center for Radio EcoShock. Here is Lamanda Joy speaking November 4th, 2012, to the Great Lakes Bioneers.
My name's Lamanda Joy. I'm very happy to be here with you today. Does everybody understand what the concept of a victory garden is? Yeah, lots of nods. Okay, so we'll go ahead and skip over that. Why am I talking about them? You know, I know the conference these last couple days has been a lot about inspiration and passion and, you know, what we can all do to make a difference. And I feel very attached to this victory garden story for a lot of reasons. The first of all is my parents. I have greatest generation parents. They met in 1941, love at first sight, at the Samuel Gompers Junior High School in Los Angeles. Something else significant happened that year. We went into war. So my parents, as young adults, lived through that whole experience, or what you call the greatest generation. That's my handsome father. He was drafted and served in the occupied forces just after the end of the war. He's in the occupied forces in Japan. So I grew up with a family that was talking about World War II a lot. You know, it was the biggest thing in their lives, and it has an impact to today. After the war was over, my parents moved to Oregon, where I was born, just outside of Portland, and my dad learned how to garden. And you'll notice in the background here, this is my great-grandfather's garden. During the war, it was a victory garden. After the war, it was just a garden again. My dad learned to garden there, and then when I came along in the late 60s, he taught me how to garden as I was growing up. So that's a little bit about that ethos. You know, I have this sort of unbroken chain of what happened during those times that I think is really valuable, so I'm very attached to this story and how it can make a difference for us today. Who here likes to garden? I hope that there's a few people. Okay, good. Who likes to eat? Everybody. Okay, good. Well, if you're an eater, then you're a good gardener. You have a good potential to be a gardener. Those of you that are gardeners, you know that once you get that bug, it's something that's kind of with you for a lifetime, right? So I got that bug very early growing up in Oregon, helping my dad garden. And I moved to Chicago in 94, and I lived for a number of years in a condo, which was lovely. It was a vintage condo. It overlooked the lake. It was very nice, but there was one problem. There's nowhere to garden. So every spring it got a little obnoxious. You know, where are we going to garden? How are we going to garden? You know, we can find neighbors with backyards. There was no community gardens to go to. It was a little bit of a problem. So February in 2006, my husband woke up one morning and he said, should we go look for a house? He's like, should we go look for a yard? I'm like, yes, let's go look for a yard. Go ahead and hit it. So we bought a yard with a house attached to it, and we called it the Yarden. So that was what it looked like when we got it, 4-foot chain link fence. Lots of sun. We didn't have any old trees that were casting shade. We didn't have any apartments looking down on it. It was nice. So we bought this yard, and there happened to be a house attached to it. And the next year, we put in this. So this is our Yarden. It's a 1,700 square feet, all organic. We do all open pollinated. We have espalier fruit trees. You know, this was my happy place, right? So I think many people are like this, or maybe I'm just like this, but I think that everybody's like me. You know, like everybody maybe has had the same experience. So I assume that everybody knew how to garden and can and bake and all cook, all these things that my parents had taught me, and I quickly learned that that wasn't the case. I started blogging about it, and I was like, whoa, people really don't know how to do this stuff, and they really want to do this stuff. So these are two of the factors that brought me to this story, but there's one more. Community. You know, I'd moved to this neighborhood. I'd been probably lived in 10 different places since I'd moved here in 94. Moved to this neighborhood. We were going to stay put, so we really wanted to support the community. And I was at my local butcher shop waiting for my order, and I looked at the wall, and I saw this photo, and I was like, what is that photo? So Reuben and Irv told me the story that this photo was taken at the building where their butcher shop was in 1943, actually. The woman that took it lived in the neighborhood her entire life, and when she passed away, her family came to the butcher shop and said, hey, we found this photo. Do you want it? They collected old photos. They said, sure. They stuck it on the wall. I came in and saw it many years later, and I was like, huh. So all these things sort of came together. I'm like, huh, I really want to understand the Victory Garden movement. And I had heard a lot of statistics. Maybe you've heard them too. 200 million people garden, 40% of the food or the produce consumed was homegrown. And I'm a little OCD, right? So I said, I'm going to figure out how they did this. That's a lot of people learning to garden. That's a lot of people growing food. How do you teach an entire city to grow their own food? So that became my research question. I really dove into what Chicago did to grow their own food during World War II. So we're going to talk a little bit about the world at war. You know, the world war started in 1941. It ended in 1945. And in between, we had four summers where people were victory gardening, 42, 43, 44, 45. Most of my information is about 1942 and 1943, so I don't have the full spectrum, but that's okay. We'll talk about those 2 years. So war on the home front. During the last part of 1941, when the country was actively preparing for war, for national defense, there are already signs of food shortages and rising prices, and especially in the category of fresh vegetables. Great industries were being transformed into munitions plants, and this quickly absorbed much of the country's pool of unemployed from the Depression. One of the first industries to feel the pinch of the labor shortage was that of fresh vegetable growers, as lower-paid field workers found higher-paying jobs in munitions and other war industries. So the farm workers were going to find better jobs, so there weren't people to grow the food. Another issue was transportation. Transportation lines were quickly conscripted to move troops and munitions, which also impacted the delivery of fresh vegetables from farms to urban areas. As one of the higher-ups in the Chicago Victory Garden movement phrased it, Uncle Sam needs trains for munitions, so we'll have to grow our own carrots. So from the smallest family groupings, and I hope that the mother was taking this picture and not pulling the plow, but we don't know because people were desperate in these times. So from the smallest family groupings to the largest organizations, people used whatever they could to prepare their victory gardens. Here you see Mayor Boston plowing up the Boston Commons. Everyone was drafted into the victory garden effort. Religious orders, movie stars. This is Veronica Lake. She was a very famous movie star at the time, and she was known for this beautiful hairstyle that she would wear. She's sort of like the peekaboo girl. She'd look from behind her hair. Well, people were emulating this hairstyle so much it was a problem because they're all becoming Rose of the Riveters, and their hair was getting caught in machinery. So they talked to Veronica Lake about doing a campaign called Hair Wins the War. If you Google that, it's a really interesting video about Hair Wins the War, how you need to change your hairstyle. So for the duration of the war, she wore her hair like this to encourage women to wear their hair up. I usually wear my hair like this when I'm gardening and presenting, but I was just too busy this morning. Anyway, movie stars were involved, cartoon characters, superheroes. I'd like to point out poor Robin schwitzing up there in his Speedo up in the corner. And, of course, popular culture. You know, you got really thirsty doing your victory garden, so you might need to drink a Dr. Pepper. Or if you got a little more thirsty, maybe you needed to drink your victory garden beer. Or if you were really thirsty, maybe you just drank a whiskey and let someone else do the gardening. But I'm just joking. I'm showing you these just to show how much this effort was part of popular culture. It wasn't something that was in the shadows. It was part of everything that people were doing. So back to the serious note. Industries, you know, steel mills, railway stations, Sears. Sears started 24,000 victory gardens in the Los Angeles area. Newspapers. And as I back to the popular culture, this is Marshall Fields. This is the window from Marshall Fields. And that sign says, to make your victory garden grow, wear gay and chic gardening apparel, located in the sport department on floor 6. So, of course, industries, especially garden industries, jumped in full force. International Harvester, which is a Chicago-based manufacturer of plows, are still here. They're called Navistar, was known to be a big supporter of the Victory Garden movement. And I'm just going to take a little detour. You know, You got to eat year-round. You can only garden for part of it. Canning was huge during World War II. So hand-in-hand with food production came food preservation. Modern freezing techniques were not widely used, and tin and other materials for store-bought canned foods were being used for munitions. So women were encouraged to can, dehydrate, brine, and otherwise preserve the harvest. And salute while you're doing it. So you can see that industrious preservation was serious business. It was a real war job. It wasn't just, oh, I'm going to make some jam to give away as Christmas gifts. There would be no food if you did not can. One of the research pieces that I ran across said that 5 billion pints were preserved during World War II every summer. Has anybody done any canning this summer? Yeah? You know, it's a lot of hot work, right? 5 billion pints nationwide. Pressure cookers and canning supplies were in such high demand that their production and distribution were overseen by the government. Serious business. So at the height of World War II, 24 million meals per day were served on the 50-plus battlefronts and fronts that the U.S. participated in. So you can see that the Victory Garden effort wasn't merely a morale-boosting luxury, it was a dire necessity. And so here's some words from the Times. Americans started gardening. Gardens began sprouting behind signposts, at the bases of railroad embankments, in schoolyards and churchyards, and in window boxes. They're attended by housewives who left babies in sandboxes while they knelt to scoop and sift the soil, and by little girls who wheeled their trowels and rakes into their plots in doll buggies, and by war workers who were back to the good earth for the first time since they waded barefoot in mud puddles as children. And so the historic gardening campaign of World War II began. So that's an overview of the nation, but let's talk specifically about Chicago. You know, I mentioned a little earlier that I'm OCD. You all know what that means. If you'll notice the acronym of this organization, they are OCD as well. So they did keep things very organized. Let's talk about the Office of Civilian Defense. Fiorello LaGuardia was appointed as the person in charge of the Office of Civilian Defense. He was not happy about this. He had other things he wanted to do, and they did not include working on the Office of Civilian Defense. But the original civilian defense organization was centered around preventative measures against air attack, sabotage, and the like. You know, there was a fear that our enemies would actually make it to our shores. So people were preparing, you know, air raids and stuff like that. It was recognized that that same organization might well function in the Victory Garden field, and the OCD administrator in D.C. issued a memorandum in January of 42 urging local coordinators to set up machinery for promoting Victory Gardens. Now, I have to tell you this from my extensive research. Not all cities use the Office of Civilian Defense as the mechanism for that. Chicago did heavily. Other cities did different things, but it seemed to work for us. So the Office of Civilian Defense activities were air raid surveillance, attack training, scrap and fat collection, war bond sales, morale committees, and Victory Gardens. So rumor has it that the Office of Civilian Defense was the brainchild of Eleanor Roosevelt. She understood the impact of the First World War on the nation, and she wanted people to feel involved, feel like they were active, not just sitting here passively while all the horribleness was going on overseas. So it was her idea. However, you know, the wife of the president at that time couldn't be, you know, the brainchild of something like that or run something like that. So for a number of months, 18 months, she went to New York, and she was Fiorello LaGuardia's secretary. So he didn't want to do it, so she became his secretary and sort of ran things from the shadows. So Chicago. Here's some words from the time. Victory gardening in World War II was radically different in character and extent from the corresponding activity in World War I. Lack of sustained promotion, absence of any organized scheme of promoting gardening, and general haphazard and wasteful methods destroyed much of the usefulness and productivity of the so-called war garden movement in World War I. World War II, at least, we'd learned from our mistakes, at least in Chicago, most of these faults were recognized before actual fighting took place. A thorough and complete scheme of organization was set up, largely due to the aid of the Chicago Park District, the local Office of Civilian Defense. There was a continuous program of promotion, stimulation, guidance, and active help. So this was our mayor at the time, Mayor Kelly, and he quickly appointed some Park District bigwigs to run the program. You know, we were lucky at the time. The Park District was probably the strongest it has ever been. Less than 10 years before 1941, in the mid-30s, we had three park districts. They're all run separately. They're all conglomerated into one park district. So they were very well organized. They had gone through this process of, you know, making their communications good. We also were in the Depression, so Chicago could afford really, you know, high-class Ivy League horticulturalists and business people to help with the Park District. So we were in a really lucky spot at that time to have a solid, strong Park District to help lead the way. So the goals of the Victory Garden movement were to stimulate as many people as possible to apply themselves during their leisure hours. They weren't expecting, you know, people to quit their jobs or do whatever. This was a leisure hour pursuit. They wanted to provide novice gardeners and those not familiar with vegetable growing the information they needed to make their efforts most productive. And you know this was written by a gardener because the final one, lay a foundation for the continued expansion of the program in peacetime. You know, maybe if that had happened, we'd be in a different world today, but we're not. And so the resources to accomplish this were a lot of vacant lots, backyards, a strong park system, school district, libraries, corporate support, and a devoted citizenry, of which 90% had never gardened before. So it wasn't that they had landscape gardened and they didn't know how to grow food. They had never gardened before. So to accomplish this, and the other mandates of the Office of Civilian Defense, the city was divided into 7 divisions, and there were more divisions in the suburbs. Division 7 doesn't show on here because it wasn't deemed to be important or possible to grow food. And all 77 Chicago neighborhoods were segregated into one of these 7 divisions. Each division had a division chairman that reported to the OCD. And each neighborhood had a community chairman that reported to the division chairman. And each block had a block captain that reported to the community chairman. And then there were also other committees, the advisory committee, the committee on demonstration gardens, the general committee, the committee on food preservation, the committee on planning, and the committee on kinds of vegetables. So there was lots of organization going on. But that's a good thing, because that meant that we were able to have the information that we have today. Because they kept track of everything. There was this level of bureaucracy that people had to work through, and it was very successful. So block captains, they're the ones that actually got most of the work done. This was their duty, to find land 3 or 4 blocks from homes of interested parties, prepare the site, arrange for plowing, participate in the Victory Garden Council, maintain enthusiasm, and plan harvest festivals. So let's take a little detour and talk about harvest festivals. This was a festival that happened in Streeterville. Streeterville is not far from Michigan Avenue. I like to show this photo because we've been interviewing senior citizens that remember Victory Gardening. And one woman lived in this neighborhood, and she said down by the lake, although this was technically Division 7, she said down by the lake there were Victory Gardens as far as the eye could see. So people took whatever space they could as far as the eye could see to grow their Victory Gardens. So this image shows the Soldier Field Harvest Festival. It was held in the exhibition hall underneath the seats in the south end of the old Soldier Field. So to us, that's the old Soldier Field. This was sponsored by the Chicago Sun, and practically every community in the Chicago metropolitan area participated. Hundreds of exhibits of garden produce, flowers, and canned goods were featured. The Park District and commercial growers also participated. Thousands of visitors participated and pledged to grow Victory Gardens in 1944.
With food inflation hard upon us and agribusiness food getting less nutritious, how can we ensure a healthy supply in our cities? This is Radio EcoShock. You are listening to Chicago Victory Gardens, Yesterday and Tomorrow, with Lamanda Joy of the Peterson Garden Project.
So Chicago, as you can see, was really serious, very organized about their Victory Garden effort, to the point where they passed an ordinance that if someone were to damage or pilfer or steal from a Victory Garden, there was an ordinance passed that you would get fines. So those fines were, this was made effective in July of 1924, which to me is like some bigwig's wife got her beautiful tomatoes stolen. So, you know, okay, now's the time, let's pass the ordinance. But anyway, there were fines of $50 to $200 levied on people that were caught busted, you know, pilfering Victory Gardens. In today's currency, that would be $650 to $2,600. It's a lot of money. Well, the question is, well, how would you know if something was a Victory Garden or just, you know, a garden? How would it apply? What is believed to be the first system of reporting or recording Victory Garden efforts for statistical purposes of any part of the United States was established in Chicago in 1942. A simple distribution system of decals in exchange for information was used, and a great deal of energy was on the part of the block captains was required. So what happened is, they called it decalomania. I think 6-color printing was a big deal back then, but 75,000 were distributed in 1942, and another 100,000 were distributed in 1943. And what happened is you gave your name, your home address, where the size of the garden was, you know, the location. Now, right, boring, snoozy statistics. The reason that we know that we had 20 million Victory Gardens across the country and 40% of the produce was grown is because this idea took off. It was Chicago's idea. It took off to the rest of the country, and cities, other metropolitan locations across the nation adopted this statistical method. So you can thank Chicago for those sound bites that we now hear. And then you started seeing these photos popping up in all sorts of press photos. This is a demo garden at Lincoln Park. This is Little Village. This is another one. Now, this tall gentleman here is the man responsible for, he worked for the Park District. He was on the Victory Garden Committee. He's the one that was responsible for the decal. He's very proud of it. He's pointing there at it. And I just want to point out that 90% of these people had never gardened before, right? You can tell by the clothing that they're wearing. So, of course, it was very important to educate people since people didn't know what they were doing. An extensive program of lectures in 6 different locations throughout the city were given. Horticultural staff in the Park District led those lectures, leaders in the seed trade, commercial growers. And in addition, individual lectures were provided by garden clubs and other organizations. In 1943, 162 sanction garden lectures happened across these six locations. And then countless garden club lectures, which I assume were unsanctioned lectures, but they're not in the stats. And then there were mass meetings showing movies or slideshows. So if you go to YouTube and put in Victory Garden movie, it'll pull up one of these movies. A lot of sweeping orchestration and a very serious narrator talking about how the family's growing their own food and what they're doing. But it's interesting, you know, and I like to think all these people got together and watched, you know, these propaganda movies to learn how to grow their own food.
You can have vegetables, lots of them, on your table next winter. You can have your own fresh vegetables on your table this summer if you have your own Victory Garden. Yes, there's no restriction on home canning and home processing of vegetables and garden fruits and berries. Plan your Victory Garden now. Get your garden plot lined up. Get the advice of a garden expert if you need it. And be prepared to grow your own for victory. Join a garden club or a community garden movement, or share a garden with your neighbor. You can help win the battle of food production. You can help our fighting men get the food they need. You can help save the vital metals used in commercial canning if you grow your own Victory Garden in 1943.
Newspapers were also involved. They passed out a lot of pamphlets that talked about Victory Garden. Now, this wasn't ornamental. This wasn't make it pretty. This was just the down and dirty of growing food. At the time, we were just coming out of the Depression. So about 30% of the men that were going to be drafted could not be drafted because of malnutrition. So vitamins and nutrition and played a big part in this information, much like we need today, very similar situation. Let's go to the next one. There are also plans that people would hand out. You know, if you have this size garden, here's a plan for a family of four. Here's another one. Here's a plan for a family of five. And these are very, very specific. They have a little bit of succession planting information. They recommend crops that are good for Chicago. It was all very specific to Chicago. There are articles in the paper, special interest articles, weekly columns from garden experts. I love this. This is a radio program called Know Your Onions on WGN. It happened Monday through Friday, and what happened is, you know, the block captains would be out in their gardens, and you'd be hearing what the problem is. This year, we had a lot of problem with squash vine borers and a few other things, you know. So they'd hear what the problems are, would trickle up through the OCD bureaucracy, and they'd be very quickly able to address these problems and teach people, okay, you're having a problem with squash vine borers, here's how you deal with it. But there are also some public interest stories that happened on this show, and I would like to share with you some of the headlines that I found in my research. Rejoice, kids, spinach seeds to be scarce. Now, did anybody read that book a couple years ago, The $25 Victory Garden? No, it was a pretty good book. Anyway, big profit on 64 cents. So back then it was a 64 cent Victory Garden. Joe Green, busy in his garden, forgets taxes. And then here we get to the fishing stories. The 4-foot radish, maybe, I don't know, maybe it was a daikon. 41 inch bean, maybe. 12 pound cabbage, I can believe that. But here's my favorite headline from the Times. Man who traded Victory Garden truck for beer, wife divorces him. Social media. What? How can that be? They didn't have Twitter back then. They actually did have something social. They had these little kiosks that were at every garden, every corner. And so if there was a newspaper article, or, hey, we're all going to get together and weed, or, hey, go see Hair Wins the War at the library this weekend, all the information that you might need to know about your garden or about your community, what was happening, would be displayed in these little kiosk things. And I have seen so many photos of these little girls standing in front of them, seen them all over at the Library of Congress. It's just very interesting. That was a very key point of how people got their information.
In just a minute, Radio EcoShock continues with Lamanda Joy on Victory Gardens, Yesterday and Tomorrow, from the Great Lakes Pioneers Conference Meetup in Chicago, November 2012. Find out what is going on today and how you can do it in your own city or town. Stay tuned.